Good afternoon. My name is Susan Muirhead, and today I'll be reading part one of the News Gazette dated for this state, Tuesday, October 9th, 2018. Let's begin with today's headlines. The first headline reads, University of Illinois, resounding beat. U of I campus's first Indigenous Peoples Day marks a lot of progress to respect heritage. This article is written by Julie Wirth, that's W-U-R-T-H, and is based out of Urbana. 30 years ago, Santa Fe artist Charlene Teeters, that's T-E-T-E-R-S, and it's Charlene, C-H-A-R-L-E-N-E, Charlene Teeters, was recruited to the University of Illinois with two other Native American students to fulfill her dream of earning a Master of Fine Arts degree. She ended up becoming the unlikely face of the campaign to abolish Chief Illiniwek and Native American mascots, which she considers dehumanizing to American Indians. Her efforts, which eventually led to the chief's retirement in 2007, made Teeters and her two young children the targets of threats and other abuse. "It was a dream come true that turned into a nightmare," she said. But on Monday, visiting the U of I for the first official campus Indigenous Peoples Day celebration, Teeters said there's been a lot of progress, quote-unquote, citing the creation of the Native American House and the rejuvenated American Indian Studies program, among other developments. "It's different," said Teeters, now a professor and academic dean at the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe, who was invited to speak at Monday's event. "My heart is full," she told the audience of more than 300 people who gathered on the South Quad. Professor Matthew Gilbert, director of the American Indian Studies program, introduced her by recalling how she summed up her fight for human dignity and Native humanity through seven carefully chosen words: "American Indians are human beings, not mascots." As academic dean at the country's flagship Native Tribal College, Teeters says she's proud to have gotten her education at Illinois and to be using it now to help teach her own people. "That's a real honor, because we are almost always the only. Far too often we're the only Native person in the classroom, the only Native person in the school, the only Native person on the panel. And there's something very sad about that, to be the only Native. We are tokens in our own homelands," she said. She said some of her memories of the U of I are painful, but she also met some incredible mentors and colleagues who stood with her on the front lines of the anti-chief campaign, citing Native activists Vernon Bellacourt and Michael Haney, and Jay Rosenstein, whose documentary In Whose Honor chronicled her fight. She recalled how civil rights organizer Kwame Ture asked Teeters to speak before his talk at Fullinger Auditorium in 1989. "I was really shy. It was terrifying to go out and speak in front of 1,000 people," she said. "But he said to me something that still stays with me. If not you, then who? I knew I had to address this issue," she said. She said his message was that all struggles against discrimination are linked, and when we see somebody who is targeted or a community that needs help, we need to stand with them as allies. Still have work to do. Teeters said her children had a tough time while they were in Champaign, but they are now both adults trying to use their education to help others. Her son earned a degree at Penn State and now works to help people with bipolar disorder or post-traumatic stress. Her daughter earned a PhD in epidemiology, from the University of North Carolina, studying the connection between race and the quality of health care people receive. "Good things came out of the struggle," she said. She said it's important for all Native Americans at the U of I and similar institutions to use their educations to lift others and develop new leaders. "We still have work to do today," she added. Teeters said later she isn't surprised the chief debate continues, noting that alumni at Dartmouth College, which dropped its Indians name and mascot in the 1970s, still bring the image to campus events. She said she was very naive back in the day when she started her anti-chief protest outside the then assembly hall. "I was thinking, they just don't know. I'll just tell them and they'll stop doing it. And here we are 30 years later," she said. "We know that this is a long-term effort. Symbol of our promise." She called Monday's celebration a good step in the right direction, saying it's important to acknowledge the Indigenous people whose land we occupy here. She also met with Chancellor Robert Jones earlier Monday and promised to recommend other speakers to bring to campus. Jones said students started the tradition of celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day years ago, and the campus decided to join in this year. "It's important for all of us to truly understand the people who came before us," Jones said, adding the campus is committed to putting Native people at the core of our educational efforts. For too long, he said, too many students, from too many backgrounds, did not find the welcoming experience they should have at the U of I. Monday's ceremony included native songs by the Bad River Singers, spiritual offerings, an Indigenous Peoples Day proclamation read by Champaign Mayor Deb Finan and Urbana Mayor Diane Marlin, and the ceremonial planting of a sugar maple near the ACES library. Jones said the tree will be a living reminder of the U of I's support for Native students and faculty and a symbol of our promise to be a vibrant community inclusive to all. A commemorative plaque will be placed by the tree, stating that it's there to remind us of the Indigenous peoples, present and past, for whom Illinois was home prior to this university's founding in 1867 and remains so to this day. The next headline reads, Downtown, Future Unclear for Century-Old Building. This article is written by Ben Sigderman and is based out of Champaign. There's a new owner of one of downtown Champaign's most historic buildings. The 109-year-old structure that houses PNC Bank at 30 Main Street was recently put up for auction, but the identity of the winning bidder hasn't been revealed. We put in a bid, but it was not the successful bid, developer Dan Hamelberg said. PNC, which did not return a request for comment, is planning to move its downtown branch to Midtown Plaza, a new development at 302 South 1st Street, led by Hamelberg. PNC asked federal regulators in June for permission to relocate the branch, and that permission was granted in August. Above the downtown branch, the law firm Thomas, Mamer, and Howey, LLP, uses 3.5 floors of the building constructed in 1909. Managing partner Bruce Warren said he's not sure what PNC's relocation will mean for the firm. We're still up in the air. It's my understanding this building has been sold, he said, but we haven't heard anything about whether we'll need to relocate. We hope to meet with them before too long. He said the firm has been looking at other commercial spaces in the event it needs to leave the building it's been at since 1946. We're preparing to leave. We got requests for proposals from 2 or 3 other commercial locations. There's lots of empty commercial space, Warren said. But I'd rather not do that, he added. Imagine the stuff we'd have to move. In the past few weeks, the city has issued 2 building permits for the new branch at Midtown Plaza, and another is under review. Hamelberg previously announced Fernando's would be going to the development, and he said another restaurant is in the works. We're still negotiating with the restaurant people, he said. The next headline reads, Doobie Brothers in CU. Multi-hit band thrives on decades of harmony. By Paul Wood, based out of Champaign. The Doobie Brothers, those who have not left the Brotherhood, still get huge responses from the crowds who've loved them since their heyday in the 1970s and 80s. We've been very fortunate in our hits. They're very singable, and people sing them back to us when we play them, says Tom Johnston. You know their songs from this era. Long Train Runnin', China Groove, Black Water, Listen to the Music, and Jesus is Just All Right. You'll probably be hearing all of them Wednesday at State Farm Center. Johnston, 70, is a founder, the lead vocalist, and songwriter for the rock group, and especially guitarist. He had health problems mid-band and was on and off with the Doobies before he took off for his solo career. That's when the Michael McDonald era began with new hits like Taking It to the Streets. For 4 decades, he's had an on-and-off career with the Doobie Brothers. 3 of them are mainstays. Johnston, Patrick Simmons on guitar and vocals, and John McPhee on guitars and fiddles. They have a large backing group. Johnston is known for both his lead guitar and vocal role in the band, as well as percussive acoustic guitar. We've got a great band, all our styles. I've played harp, harmonica, harp harmonica, I believe that's a type of harmonica, a lot early on, like Long Train Runnin'. John does it on the tour, Johnston said. The Doobies got off to a slow start in San Jose, California, the co-founder said. The first album didn't do that well, but at the time we thought it was the best thing since sliced bread. There was a lot of acoustic stuff. We wouldn't have played it like that on tour. The band gelled, thanks to its harmonies, he said. There are 3 voices on Rocking on the Highway, and that worked, so all the songs we wrote always had harmonies, Johnston said. What makes the Doobies kick? We came from blues and rock, I came from R&B, and we also had some jazz influence. They still have the energy to do about 80 shows a year. Last year they were on tour with Santana in Australia, and this year with Steely Dan. We've always managed to land on our feet, Johnston joked. Though the ban broke up in 1982, a benefit for Vietnam vets 5 years later got several variations of the band together, with four drummers, two keyboards, and songs from all the performers, Johnston said. Johnston has some work on the side. I've done a couple of solo albums and been going ever since, the multi-instrumentalist said. It's been a great ride, with the audience keeping our energy up, and that's why we're out there. Now let's take a look at our weather forecast over the next week. This is provided to us by Greg Soule and his column on the weather front. A strong frontal zone extends from the Great Lakes region to the southern plains. This system will produce widespread rain and heavy storms along the front. Northwest of the front and its associated deepening low pressure, rain will fall, and farther northwest, snow over parts of the northern plains will move into parts of the upper Mississippi Valley by tomorrow. Tropical moisture and daytime heat will aid in producing rain and storms over parts of the southern mid-Atlantic, southeast, and Gulf Coast through Tuesday evening. Hurricane Michael is forecast to move north into the Gulf of Mexico while strengthening and continue to move north to the Florida Panhandle by tomorrow. Today, 87 degrees. Warm and humid, partly sunny, an isolated shower and thunderstorm late. South wind 12 to 22 miles per hour, chance of rain is at 30%. Overnight, mild, couple of showers and thunderstorms, chance of rain is at 40%. Wednesday, the high will be 76, the low will be 69. Windy, cloudy, periods of showers and storms, chance of rain will be at 80%. Overnight, colder, chance of rain is at 40%. Thursday, the high is 58, the low is 47, much cooler, sunny. Friday, the high will be 56, the low will be 38, cool, partly cloudy. Saturday, the high will be 57, the low will be 38. Illini football at Memorial Stadium, a 50% chance of showers, cloudy, westerly wind, 12 miles per hour. Kickoff temperature will be 56 degrees. You can also hear Greg Soule's weather reports weekdays on 1400 WDWS, 97.5 WHMS, and 107.9 WKIO. And now, top of the morning, something to get you going today, courtesy of Jim Rosso. It's homecoming week at Arcola High School, where on Friday, senior Molly Sue Mahana will take over our Snapchat account to show how everyone is so friendly and willing to help each other, she said. Mahana, one of 35 correspondents participating in year 3 of High School Confidential, is headed to Parkland College to major in elementary education. Her career goal? Teaching in a classroom full of students, the 17-year-old said. Follow along during Friday's Snapchat takeover by searching for News Gazette on the app. Until then, follow Mahana on Twitter. That's handle Molly, M-O-L-L-Y, underscore Mahana, M-A-H-A-N-N-A-H. On Instagram, her handle is at Molly Mahana. And Snapchat, Malsue, M-O-L-S-S-U-E. And at newsgazette.com, here's what was trending at our website, which in a 7-day period ending Sunday saw 1,304,490 page views. The three top stories: 1, Unity Community Mourns Loss; 2, Police Chief, Apparent Suicide Outside Tuscola Restaurant; and 3, Casey Man Accused of Punching Sheriff's Deputy at Luke Bryan Concert. The three top sports stories were 1, High School Football Scoreboard from October 5th, 2018; 2, Silence Not a Virtue for Underwood's Illini; 3, New Look Illini Set Fresh Tone in Underwood's Second Season. And the three top videos: 1, Luke Bryan Farm Tour Takes Over Posotum; 2, Join Waters Farm for Harvest; and 3, Levy, Big Ten Win, A Big Thing for Illini. The three top photo galleries: 1, High School Football, St. Thomas More versus Unity; 2, Luke Bryan Farm Tour 2018; and 3, the U of I Basketball Media Day 2018. In history, area history, in 1918, Corporal Charles Gunlock of Champaign died of influenza at Camp Upton in New York. In 1968, L. Harlan Swisher of Urbana was elected the first executive director of the newly formed Champaign County Council on Alcoholism. In 2003, Provost Richard Herman learned he would not be leaving the University of Illinois for the top job at the University of Florida. The Florida Board of Trustees chose James Bernard Macon, president of the University of Utah, as its next president. The vote for Macon was unanimous. In international history, today's highlight, on October 9, 1776, a group of Spanish missionaries settled in present-day San Francisco. And on this date, in 1888, the public was first admitted to the Washington Monument. In 1910, a coal dust explosion at the Starkville mine in Colorado left 56 miners dead. In 1914, the Belgian city of Antwerp fell to German forces during World War I. In 1930, Laura Ingalls became the first woman to fly across the United States as she completed a nine-stop journey from Roosevelt Field, New York, to Glendale, California. And in 1936, the first generator at Boulder, later Hoover Dam, began transmitting electricity to Los Angeles. The next headline reads, The Yards Project, MTD still hopeful after first grant loss. This article is written by Tim Dittman and is based out of Champaign. The Champaign-Urbana Mass Transit District is zero for one in landing federal grants for the planned downtown development known as The Yards. But with word yet to come on another grant and an election less than a month away, local officials are hopeful for good news soon. MTD spokeswoman Lisa Mead, MEID, said the agency didn't make the cut for a 5339 grant from the Federal Transit Administration. Mead said the MTD may hear soon whether it will be awarded a build grant from the U.S. Department of Transportation. In both cases, the MTD asked for $25 million. There is also expected to be an unspecified amount of private funding for the estimated $200 million yards project, which could include an expansion of the Illinois Terminal, parking decks, 100-plus apartments, another downtown hotel, convention space, and an arena for a potential Illini Division I hockey team. U of I Athletic Director Josh Whitman and MTD Managing Director Carl Natt were among a local contingent that traveled to Washington, D.C. last month to meet with transit officials, policy advisors, and U.S. Representative Rodney Davis about the project. The next headline reads, Champaign Teachers Contract, There for Support. Unit 4 and CFT's eighth round of negotiations breaks down despite mediator. This article is written by Lindsay Jones and Tim Mitchell and is based out of Champaign. Inside the Mellon Administrative Center, Unit 4 officials and a federal mediator prepared for the latest round of negotiations. Outside Monday afternoon, members of the Champaign Federation of Teachers circled together, rallying in support of their union's efforts to negotiate with the district that same night. Some teachers pumped their fists in the air. Some held signs that read, Fair Contract or Proud to be CFT. We're all really here to support each other, teacher Amber Owens said. I think it's hard because it's a day off, but the crowd says a lot about how much we support each other. Union Second Vice President Michelle Anderson told the News Gazette that negotiations broke down at 7:30 p.m. Monday. She said the two sides stopped negotiating for the night. Anderson said that union members will hold a strike authorization vote at 4 p.m. on Thursday. Monday's meeting between Unit 4 and CFT representatives marked the eighth get-together in recent months and the first with a federal mediator. Per a CFT request, both the union and Unit 4 agreed to federal mediation after negotiations stalled completely in late August. Unit 4 has described the unresolved issues between it and CFT as largely financial in nature and noted that the CFT rejected at least two proposals the district offered up earlier this summer. What CFT President Jen White has described as sticking points, class sizes, and teachers' expanded workloads were echoed among those gathered on Monday. Kindergarten teacher Wendy Maxson, M-A-X-O-N, carried a sign that told readers, 30 is the speed limit for Prospect Avenue, not the number of students she should have in her classroom. It hasn't reached that number yet, she said, but if we don't stop it, we've got to cut it off somewhere. Garden Hills ESL teacher Leslie Till parked her Oh Honey Pie food truck in the lot nearby, swapping her teaching role out for her small business owner role. I just thought maybe some people might be on the fence about coming or not, but maybe if they know there was pie here, they'd come, she said. As long as people want pie, I'll be here. Till described Garden Hills classes as large enough to merit an aide in every room, although she didn't have exact numbers. She also described a sense of exhaustion that came from extra professional development requirements. We're not about salary, obviously, but there's just so much extra stuff that I feel like is coming down from above that's being put on our shoulders, she said. I think that maybe we know what's best for us and our students, and sometimes I feel like people higher up don't understand that. And it just gets so exhausting to continuously modify or continuously go to these professional developments. The next headline reads, U of I Police Department, teens accused of mugging student for phone. This article is written by Ben Zigderman and is based out of Urbana. Two teenagers were placed in juvenile detention Monday after allegedly striking a U of I student on the main quad Sunday evening and attempting to take his phone. The University of Illinois Police Department said it interviewed the teens Monday, who weren't identified because they're minors, and they were taken to a youth detention center, according to a campus safety notice. They and another person allegedly approached a U of I student at 6:40 p.m. Sunday on the east side of the quad, yelled at the student, and then the two teenagers allegedly struck the student and demanded his cell phone, according to police. Bystanders came over to help the student, who wasn't injured, and the young people rode away on bicycles, the notice said. The U of I police thanked community members for providing information, which aided in the investigation of this incident. The next headline reads, Champaign Police, Sunday shootings presumed related. This article is also written by Ben Zigderman and is based out of Champaign. Local police responded to two shootings Sunday evening that are believed to be related. A man was shot in the arm in the first shooting, which happened shortly before 8 p.m., in the 1600 block of Sheffield Road in Champaign, according to Champaign Police spokesman Tom Yellick. The victim left the scene before police arrived, but was located Monday morning and taken to a hospital. When police arrived at the scene Sunday, Yellick said they learned an unknown number of suspects exchanged multiple rounds of gunfire outside of a residence, resulting in vehicle and property damage. Later Sunday, around 10:30 p.m., Urbana police said shots were fired into a home in the 1200 block of West Eads Street. None of the six people in the house, ranging in age from 1 to 71, were injured, according to Lieutenant Rich Surlis of the Urbana Police Department. 40 shell casings were located at the scene, and police determined that multiple sedans pulled up to the house, fired at it, then fled the scene northbound on Goodwin Avenue. Urbana and Champaign Police are working together to confirm the motive and involved individuals from both incidents, the departments announced on Monday. Anyone with information is encouraged to contact Champaign Police at the following number. Here it is, 217-351-4545, or Urbana Police at 217-384-2320. Tips can be submitted anonymously to Crime Stoppers at 217-373-TIPS, online at champaigncountycrimestoppers.com, or via the P3 Tips smartphone app. The next headline reads, Urbana City Council, agreement with union okayed, pay raises, uniform allowance among provisions for city workers. This article is written by Adalberto Toledo and is based out of Urbana. The Urbana City Council on Monday approved a collective bargaining agreement with the AFSCME Local 1331 that includes hourly rate increases, uniform allowances, and other provisions for city workers, measures that will increase the city's budget. The council also approved amending the budget in their closed session and rubber-stamped an increase of $165,020 for a one-time payment that covers retroactive hourly rate increases of 1% for 2017, 2018, 2% for 2019, as well as a one-time ratification incentive of $2,500 for eligible bargaining unit members and other retroactive payments. The new contract also sets up a 2 and 2.25% base hourly wage increase for 2019 through June 30th, 2021, when the contract expires. But it gets rid of the Me Too agreement, which guarantees the hourly wage contract terms are extended to workers represented by AFSCME in favor of the lump sum $2,500 bonuses. The city estimates it will save about $57,850 at the end of 2020, by eliminating the compensation match. Urbana Mayor Diane Marlin was pleased with the work of union representatives and city staff in getting the agreement together. Obviously, our main concern is to get a contract that we can live with fiscally, Marlin said. We're addressing our structural budget deficiencies and deficits and rebuilding our city reserves. It will help us keep a lid on increases in recurring costs, and that's the bottom line. Is to get a handle on recurring costs. Whatever the sticking points were, we worked them out to the satisfaction of both parties, Marlin said. We're very glad we have a four-year plan that helps us plan for the future. Standby pay will increase from $130 to $160 for 2017 and 2018, and $170 after 2019. And the city agrees to continue buying uniforms from mechanics and will provide a $350 uniform allowance, as well as granting a $650 uniform allowance to all our other uniform employees. The bottom line, on top of the shelling out $165,020 right away, the city's budget will see an increase in recurring expenditures of $25,928. Most of that is coming from the general operating fund, $134,413 for the one-time payment, and $22,528 in recurring payments. The next headline reads, In Memory, Sonia, S-O-N-I-A, Orbuch, O-R-B-U-C-H, Sonia Orbuch. I was not afraid of bombs. Jewish girl helped sabotage Nazis in 40s Poland. This article is based out of Court Madera, California, and is written by the Associated Press. Sonia Orbuch, who survived the Holocaust as a teenager in Eastern Europe by joining a resistance group that was sabotaging the Nazis, has died in Northern California, a newspaper reported. She was 93. Orbuch died September 30th at her home in Court Madera, the San Francisco Chronicle reported Saturday, quoting her son, Paul Orbuch, and a longtime friend, Fred Rosenbaum. No cause of death was given. She was born Sarah Shainwald, that's S-H-A-I-N-W-A-L-D, in the eastern Polish town of Lubom, and was 16 when German forces took over the area in 1941 and began killing Jews, the newspaper reported. Her family fled to nearby forests and hid there for the winter. By spring, they joined a group made up of Soviet soldiers and civilians who targeted Nazi troops by blowing up trains, ambushing convoys, and sniping at outposts. The group was reluctant to take in a Jewish family with no military skills, but the leaders were persuaded by Sonia's uncle, who had been a scout in the Polish army and knew the region. The group thought her original name sounded too Jewish, so she was renamed Sonia. She had no medical training, but Sonia learned to tend to the wounded. She kept watch and went on raids. She always carried two grenades, one for the Nazis and one for herself. She did not want to be taken alive. Suddenly, I was not afraid of bombs. Me, a girl who had been afraid of a fly, she said later. After the war, she married Isaac Orbuch, and they moved to the U.S. Her husband died in 1998. Later in life, Sonia Orbuch became an author and lecturer. In 2009, she wrote her autobiography, Here There Are No Sarahs, and helped found the Jewish Partisan Educational Foundation, which honors the memory of the 20,000 to 30,000 Jews who fought in resistance groups in World War II. The foundation confirmed her death on its website. She deeply touched young people, in particular teens, who were the same age as Sonia when she fled to the forest and fought back. Rosenbaum, a longtime friend and Orbuch's co-author, wrote in a eulogy that was read at her funeral on Wednesday. Orbuch is survived by a son, a daughter, and a granddaughter, the Chronicle said. Today on WDWS 1400 AM, tune in for Morning Show with Senator Dick Durbin is scheduled to check in at 7:40 AM. Penny for Your Thoughts, open line at 9 a.m., followed by CASA's Rush Record at 9:45, and the News Hour with Urbana Mayor Diane Marlin, who chats with host Scott Beatty at 4:20 p.m. To chime in, you can call 217-356-9397 or text the following number, 217-351-5357. And as always, you can find those podcasts on newsgazette.com. Also on newsgazette.com, Inside Illini Basketball with Scott Ritchie, NG beat writer on Brad Underwood's fun-loving Illini. It's a good thing. Sports are supposed to be fun. They've got some really gritty competitors, but a little levity is not bad. It's a brand new team. How the season shakes out, you can't determine in October. For our entire menu, visit our website and click on podcasts. I'm Susan Muirhead, and this has been part one of the News Gazette, dated for this date Tuesday, October 9th, 2018. We'll resume with part two shortly, so please stay with us.